From Wisconsin Public Radio, this is Newsmakers. I'm Ezra Wall in La Crosse. Thank you very much for joining us today. We're taking a look back at 2021 as we get 2022 kicked off to a good start. And we start in really fine fashion with a nationally renowned advocate for civil rights. The Reverend William Barber has been a key player in restarting Dr. Martin Luther King's Poor People's Campaign across the country. And he was kind enough to join us last year ahead of a virtual appearance that he made at a Martin Luther King Jr. Day event here in La Crosse. And Reverend Barber spoke with our Hope Kerwin.
What strikes you from his life and his work that is most relevant in light of today's trials?
Well, first of all, I think the entire life of Martin Luther King and his legacy continues to speak to us in profound ways, but particularly his last work, the Poor People's Campaign, and the last night that he was with us in Memphis. There were some words that he said that we need to hear today. I'll be talking about them. Most of the time people say it was, I've been to the mountaintop and I've looked over and I've seen the promised land. I might not get there with you, but we as a people will get there. They often focus on that, which was a refrain, a closing that he often shared. It was more profound because he got shot the next day and murdered. But before getting there, he was talking about Memphis, talking about poverty, talking about injustice. Here he was, a PhD in Memphis, standing with garbage collectors. And when he looked at the situation in America and the triune evils of poverty, racism, militarism, he said nothing would be more tragic than for us to stop at this point or for us to turn back at this point. And when I think about the fact that we literally today have 43% of this nation that still lives in poverty and low wealth, and since COVID, another 8 million people have been added, and we still have to deal with systemic racism in attitude, actions, policies, and personality. And even in Wisconsin, when I look at the fact that 40% of people in Wisconsin are poor and low wealth, 1.5 million of them are white, 700,000 are black or people of color. Even in Wisconsin, 400,000 people without health care, and over a million people in Wisconsin that work every day for less than a living wage. Think about that, less than a living wage. And they were like that before COVID hit, and it's only gotten worse. We must address systemic racism and policies, systemic poverty, ecological devastation, the war economy, and the false moral narrative of religious nationalism. And nothing would be more tragic than for us to turn back at this point.
As we consider the legacy of Dr. King, I think some people in our predominantly white community here, you know, might think of racism, might think of the civil rights movement as something in the past, as something in Dr. King's time. And I just wonder how community members can talk to each other openly about race and privilege and prejudice in the present, in the now.
One of the ways we have to talk about race is, first of all, to talk about systemic racism, not just attitudes, but policies. The attitudes are often cover-ups for the policies. Ibram Kendi, in his book, Stamped from the Beginning, talks about racism is about policy. So we have to deal with systemic racism. But then we have to show how systemic racism is not just about black people. When you talk about systemic racism, I'll be talking about how it affects Latino people, how it affects indigenous people, and the policies that are rooted in systemic racism, but also the collateral damage toward white people. That changes the conversation in the room, because people began to understand that while racism, systemic racism, may be targeted at black, brown, and indigenous people, it ultimately undermines democracy. It's not just anti-black, it's anti-democracy.
The Reverend William Barber with WPR's Hope Kerwin. We're taking a look back at 2021 here on Newsmakers Today. And in February of 21, we talked about the film Amplifying the Voices of Black Youth and Their Parents. It's actually a two-part film. And we talked to the film's director and some of the people who work in our community advocating on behalf of race and diversity in the La Crosse area. And they talked about the film, which is, interestingly, it's not like you can go on like Netflix and watch it or something like that. It's designed to be incorporated into a facilitated workshop type setting. So you talk about the film, and then different trained facilitators help bring people through some pretty difficult conversations, or conversations at least that can be difficult about race and equity in our communities. And we talked about that film. Peter Mua is the filmmaker behind Amplifying the Voices of Black Youth and Their Parents in the La Crosse area. Peter, as you put this film together, you said that you had kind of wanted to work on a film like this. What is it about your own experiences that made you want to be part of a project like this?
So I was born and raised in La Crosse, Wisconsin. I've lived there for 20 plus years, and I've had issues with people around the community as well, and people just don't understand.
So when you're talking about your own experiences that you've been through, have you experienced racism in the community in the same way that these students have?
Yes, very similar. I'm not Black, but I'm definitely not part of the majority. And I've seen and I've been treated very different from especially the other kids around me. And I've noticed that quite a bit. And it was tough.
I'm going to turn to a couple of our other guests here. We've got two representatives from Hope Restores here. We've got Shai Bernard and Shamaya Curtis. Also with us is Diana Diaz-Granados from Better Together in La Crosse County. Thomas Harris is here as well. He's with the University of Wisconsin-La Crosse. He works in the Office of Multicultural Student Services. Let's talk with Shai and Shamaya about Hope Restores and the work that you're doing. What's the importance of a film like this? It focuses in one part on Black youth, but also on their parents. Talk about what a project like this can do as far as raising awareness to the plight of minorities and specifically Black people in the La Crosse area.
So the film actually did a great job raising awareness. It opened people's eyes that weren't aware, especially of the pain that the teenagers were going through. We got a lot of compassion from that. It's because we don't want our youth to be suffering. And so when we heard the stories that they shared about the injustice that they're facing in their schooling, that became really emotional. And a lot of people want to know what they can do to change those dynamics. It educated people in La Crosse area about what it's like to be African-American in Western Wisconsin in a small town. The film also has challenged people to say, what can I do to make some changes, you know? And people have asked that question and they keep on wanting to know, you know, what is it that we can do to change the injustice and give equality for everybody? So the film has done a lot.
Diana Diaz-Granados is with the Better Together in La Crosse County.
Well, Better Together in La Crosse County is a youth mental health project. And we got involved in this work by, you know, recognizing and the need to recognize and raise awareness in our community that experiencing racism is a risk factor for poor mental health. We use this film to raise that awareness that we do have a problem and that it needs to be, that racism needs to be treated and just like we treat, you know, trauma.
Part one of the film focuses mostly on students. Part two of the film focuses on their parents, and it's an amazing project. Thomas Harris is with us. He's with the UWL Office of Multicultural Student Services.
We wanted to make the film be put in a position of usage in a special way for organizations or groups to actually see the film showing that'll be facilitated by a trained facilitator. And then after they've gotten to a certain point, they know up front that they're going to be looking at the film as a commitment of a process of making change happen in their organizations, businesses, or the groups that they're in, if it's church or whatever it is, and try to make it a real change-making effort, particularly for white people in organizations that are led, controlled, and the majority of their memberships are white or they're all white. So they can learn through that process to look at the introspection of what they have in order to make a difference on what they could have in the future.
The last person you heard speaking there, Thomas Harris, was the assistant director of UWL's Office of Multicultural Student Service. And Thomas has worked with us on Newsmakers and at WPR for a long time and has recently retired. So congratulations, Thomas, and thank you very much for your contributions to Newsmakers and indeed to our whole community through the years. In March, we started talking about birds on Newsmakers because who doesn't want to go for a nice walk in the spring and look at all the birds that are out and about and get some nice exercise in at the same time. Carla Bloom joined us from the International Owl Center in Houston, Minnesota, and Barbara Dirksen from the Wisconsin Society of Ornithology. And starting it off, I was telling Carla about a camping trip where I heard some owls out in the woods that kept me up absolutely all night long. And she was reminded of how many opportunities there are when we're outside in Wisconsin to hear some of our feathered friends. So I was curious as to what it was they were communicating to each other back and forth. Is that just chit chat, or like, do they know which owls they're communicating with specifically? Like when I hear your voice, I know it's Carla. Do they know which owls they're communicating with like that?
Yes, they do absolutely know who they're communicating with. And sometimes the calls are literally, this is my territory. I'm just letting everybody know it's taken. But if you have a stranger come in, whoa, then those vocalizations can get really heated. And barred owls just have this reputation of being super vocal, and they get really worked up easy. So they get into, their normal hoot is this, oh, 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 you know, the who cooks for you, who cooks for you all. Then if they get really excited, they can get into the caterwauling, oh, 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 ah, 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 and people start like, what are there monkeys in the woods or what? And then they can do this other call that has been described as an alarm call, but I've seen it in more context than just alarm. And it sounds like a woman being murdered in the woods. It's like a, and then usually you get two long hoots on the end. But then there's individual variations. I've heard recorded one that does, and that's how that bird does it every time. So barred owls just do these crazy things, and nobody totally understands all of their vocalizations. They, I'm confident, understand them. We humans just don't have it all sorted out yet.
That is amazing. So, Barbara, when you're out in the woods and you were naming all kinds of little birds that are around this time of the year and some more that are coming later in the spring and summer, what about this issue of technology? Carla brought up the negative side of drones, but I could imagine technology improvements making it a lot easier for people to be able to identify the birds that they're seeing out and about and to let other people know about it. Are there websites that are common for people to use for this or different applications that people take with them on the go to be able to identify the birds that they're seeing?
Yes, there are. First of all, Cornell Laboratory of Ornithology is one of the best places to get all kinds of information about birds, their sounds, their habitats, just videos, all kinds of common birds and birds that are similar to them, so you can sort things out. So that's a very helpful place to go. Out in the field, there are apps that you can put on your smartphone that help you identify, or you can look up a bird to see if you're looking at, if you think you've got the right one. There's one called Merlin that helps you sort things out and perhaps identify it. I'm not sure if it's 100% accurate or not. I don't use it a whole lot, but a lot of people do. So I'm not sure how to recommend it, but I think it's good. And then there are other guides that you can just, you have that have pictures. There's a Sibley guide, there's Audubon, there's a bunch of them. Some of them are free. Some of them are just a few dollars.
I don't know what I'm doing. I know I see pigeons in my backyard, and I see, you know, I hear the owl that we talked about earlier, and I see cardinals hopping around from bush to bush. And other than that, not a whole lot. But when I go out and for a walk, or I go see some things, I hear all these kinds of bird sounds. I see them. I'm interested in learning more about this, but I just don't know what I'm doing. So where does a person, like, where does a novice like myself need to start, who just doesn't have education in or experience in this area? Barbara?
Start slow. Be patient. People learn in different ways. Sometimes people really tune into the sounds. Other people, depends on, you know, how you, well you hear. Or I really tuned in to bird songs when I was a kid, and that was my first real kind of passion about learning the songs. And the best way to really learn quickly is to find somebody who's leading a field trip, and that often occurs in spring for during migration, and sometimes in summer. And you know, the leader will usually know what the birds are and be able to point them out and try to be in an area where the birds will be more visible.
Carla Bloom and Barbara Dirksen talking with us about birds on Newsmakers. As we take a look at the year in review, we're revisiting some of our favorite conversations from 2021 as we get 2022 off to a good start. Our year in review segments will continue after a quick time out here on Newsmakers. Remember, if you'd like to get in touch with the program, you can always do so on our website, which is wpr.org/newsmakers. That's where you can see previous episodes. If you'd like to email us some comments directly, maybe a note about something you'd like to hear on our show in the future, you can do that, newsmakers@wpr.org. newsmakers@wpr.org. This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. It's Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Ezra Wall, and as 2022 gets started, we are taking a look back at our favorite conversations from last year, 2021. I thank you all very much for joining us. One of the fun things we got to talk about was a new YouTube show from Bo Sean. Bo is the founder of For Independent Hmong Farmers, and she did a YouTube show with help from La Crosse Local and others, and it was featured a lot of interesting recipes that Bo grew up with, influenced by Hmong culture, and they looked a lot of fun, and she had a lot of interesting guests. But the bulk of our conversation was really about the effort behind that YouTube show, which was to offer support to Hmong farmers as they were coming out of a couple of really tough years related to COVID. And in July, we were talking about just that, how much Hmong farmers locally depend on the ability to sell their goods at local farmers markets in order to make a living, and how that was all affected during COVID-19.
Well, since my parents have been Hmong farmers vendors in La Crosse County since 2004, and in the years that I've worked with them, I've seen the struggles they experienced. And all our neighbors, all the Hmong farmers, have similar struggles, such as food loss, profit loss, and various financial struggles. And being a part of an underrepresented group really pushed me to want to advocate for these farmers. About a year and a half into starting this nonprofit, my goal was to shine a light on these Hmong farmers, mm-hmm. who they are. We featured some of the local gardens, some other specialty items like fresh ginger, bitter melons, mustard greens. And I wanted to share more correct information about who the Hmong farmers are and what they grow, because in the past years, and even this year recently, we would have customers that would ask me where our food comes from. And some of them would even ask me if we got them from China or Mexico. So I would give these customers who are asking the correct information, and I just love to point them to the nonprofit page, because we feature gardens and we feature the different markets that these growers grow to. But other than that, this year was crucial to start raising funds because of the pandemic that that the farmers had experienced through last year and even the year before that. Because of the impact of the pandemic was so drastic and negative for their business, for any small business, which they are.
Yeah. And you talked about how close to home this hits for you because your parents are farmers whose goods are part of these markets that the farmers go to. Did you grow up in the garden, so to speak?
Yes. So from a small age, my mom was always a farmer, even just to grow to help sustain our family. But she that was part of her livelihood. Like she would grow to sell her produce, and she's really good at that. So all through my life, I just remember like going to the garden really early in the morning before school and then heading back to the garden after school. So I was always dirty.
What's the first thing you remember growing?
Sugar snap peas.
Yum.
Yes. And it's great because if you're harvesting super early in the morning around 5:30 a.m. and you get hungry, just snack on them.
who needs breakfast, right?
Right.
How much of a household's income for these farmers is dependent on their farming?
For most farmers, they fully depend on the annual income from farmers market every year. For many, this is their trade and their livelihood. We do have some vendors that are either part-time or do work full-time, but because of the pandemic, I would say again, that has greatly affected the outcome of who has a job and who doesn't anymore.
That's Bo Sean of the Organization for Independent Hmong Farmers here on Newsmakers as we continue our look back at 2021. Also in July, we had a show about bicycle advocacy and encouraging people to get out and pedal around town and pedal on the paths all over the Driftless area and get out and see the world via bicycle. And a longtime advocate and very experienced, in fact, world traveler on the bicycle is Matthew Kristen, who is the owner and operator of Wrench and Roll Collective. It's a bike shop on La Crosse's north side on Caledonia Street. Matthew talked to us about his experience introducing bikes in the classroom and also about some of the environmental advantages. But he starts off by talking about Wrench and Roll and what makes it a little bit different from your regular bike shop.
Part of the character of the shop is that we basically believe that somebody walks in, they should leave a little more knowledgeable than when they came in. We offer classes and sessions, try to promote a variety of ways that the community can engage in cycling. That's inherently our mission. I probably have done over 75,000 miles on a bicycle in my life on 4 out of the 6 main continents. And part of my passion is to share that with as many other people, both in the functional aspects of getting a bike to where you need to go. I moved from that into, I started an after school program at Logan Middle School to try and promote more kids to get on bikes and do it more safely. I also tried to include it in my science classes where if you use a bike or walk, you save a pound a mile of CO2 from going into the atmosphere. So every time I'd get 2,000 miles, we'd have a 1-ton party. And that was a good educational tool, especially when the kids are like, hey, why are we getting root beer floats today?
What do you see as important areas of advocacy that would be beneficial for the bicycling community?
The areas that we need to improve is, one, we really need the business community to understand the role of bicycle and pedestrian alternative options for transportation and the key economic role that plays. Simply put, the cost of getting cars to businesses is way, way more expensive than bicycle and pedestrian infrastructure. For instance, a bike lane in front of a retail section can improve retail sales from 3% to 49%. It's been proven across the country. The second area is to make routes complete. In other words, when you start to walk somewhere and bike somewhere, you can get there without having to step into the street because there's the sidewalk ends, or you know, you don't have to hunt around for an alternate bike route because there's, you know, now you're having to cross or deal with West Avenue or downtown 4th Street. And so completing routes for people and making those more useful. The other aspect is education, helping the community at large understand, you know, all the benefits, the ramifications, and the costs involved in just focusing on vehicle transportation.
We're talking with Matthew Kristen, who is the owner of Wrench and Roll Collective. It's a bike shop on Caledonia Street in La Crosse on the north side. I was intrigued when you talk about touring on the bike, and you talked about having been all over the world. What's the most exciting place you were touring on a bicycle?
Well, one of the bigger highlights in my life was to hit the Madonna di Gesalo Shrine and the Bicycle Museum just south of Bellagio, Italy. We've got an adventure cycling series where once a month we learn about how to use the bike to go on overnight destinations. The Coulee region is filled, rich with places that you can bike and have a really great, enjoyable experience.
And where can people find more information about some of the opportunities that you mentioned?
We have ours posted on our Facebook page, so Wrench and Roll Collective. They can call the shop, look for posters. So we usually have flyers up.
That's Matthew Kristen from Wrench and Roll Collective, a bike shop in North La Crosse. Well, July was good for us here at WPR until it wasn't. In July of 2021, following a tragic collision, our own Gene Purcell passed away. He was the director of Wisconsin Public Media at the time of his death, which is our parent organization. But longtime listeners of this program will recognize the name of its former host. Gene Purcell dedicated almost his entire professional life to public media, all starting in La Crosse right here, where he started as a student reporter at WLSU-FM. Through the decades, he worked his way all the way up the ladder. He was WLSU's news director, program manager. When WLSU became part of Wisconsin Public Radio, he became the regional manager here at WPR in La Crosse, eventually moving to Madison to take on responsibilities at the Educational Communications Board, which is part of our organization, and ultimately as the director of Wisconsin Public Media. Gene tragically passed away last July after an accident. Outside of work, he was a bit of a music nerd. Purcell played the guitar, collected thousands of albums, restored old jukebox. He also had a short stint in rock star management, as you'll hear in this episode of Wisconsin Life. His sister, Connie Purcell, shares the story and dedicates this essay to Gene's wife, Ruth, and hopes the story makes her sister-in-law smile.
Many of you may not know, but in addition to all Gene's notable career accomplishments, he was also Pat Benatar's public relations guy for one night. Gene liked to keep this one on the down low. It was a hot summer night in the early 80s. Gene and I were both living in La Crosse at the time, and we used to hang out. We decided we needed to beat the heat, since neither of us had AC in our apartments. Gene suggested we meet at a smoky little neighborhood bar to shoot some pool and cool off with some refreshments. I'm all in. We met at the agreed-upon place at the agreed-upon time. This was an accomplishment in itself, as we were both too broke to afford a landline, and this was way, way before cell phones. So we're having a few, shooting some pool, and mostly minding our own business. A younger crowd came in, our age actually, but way younger than the regulars. We found out soon enough they had made the rounds downtown and were making one more stop before calling it a night. Soon they had us surrounded, and the commentary began. Is that Pat Benatar? What's she doing here? She has a concert tomorrow night. Will you sing for us? I was confused. I started looking around. I caught Gene's eye, and he gave me the hand across the throat gesture, the do not speak sign. I've seen that sign before. Gene quickly summed up the current situation. He realized before I did that I had been mistaken for Pat Benatar. We were told she had a concert scheduled the next night in La Crosse. It may be hard to believe now, but back in the day, I was told I was a dead ringer for Pat Benatar. We had the same short dark hair and dark eyes, similar facial features, and a slight body build. That's where the similarities ended. Our voices were a certain miss. Gene is playing along. He is playing the game. He is working the crowd. I heard someone say, "Brilliant idea, man, hiding out with the locals." Someone else said, "Sneaky lady." Our jig is up if I open my mouth. Not to worry, though. My big brother, the PR guy, calmed the masses and explained that I needed to rest my voice for the concert tomorrow night. There would be absolutely no conversation with Pat. This seemed to satisfy the crowd. I spent the rest of the night basking in our newfound and short-lived fame. I smiled happily, toasted our free drinks merrily, and posed with my PR guy for photos with Pat's admirers. We shut down that little bar that night. We left with 1,000 well wishes and good luck at your concert from our fans. I'm happy to report we even had a little jingle still left in our pockets. I like to think all these years later, someone still recalls their chance encounter with Pat Benatar and her PR guy at some dive bar in La Crosse, Wisconsin. Rest in peace, big brother, in loving memory of Gene Purcell, also known as Pat Benatar's PR guy for one night.
That was Connie Purcell sharing a memory of her beloved brother, Gene Purcell. He was the former director of Wisconsin Public Media and passed away this summer. Connie dedicates that story to his wife, Ruth. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum. Once there was a man.
From Wisconsin Public Radio, this is Newsmakers. I'm Ezra Wall in our Southwest Wisconsin studios here at the University of Wisconsin La Crosse. Today on Newsmakers, we're taking a look back at 2021 and our favorite stories and most impactful stories through that year as we get ready to kick off this new year. We're talking about one of those conversations right now, which took place in October. It was getting a little bit chilly, not quite cold, and homelessness was on our minds here as an encampment of residents without access to traditional housing was in Huska Park here in La Crosse. We talked to La Crosse Mayor Mitch Reynolds and Lauren Juneau of the YWCA and some others about efforts to find more permanent housing for that group of homeless people in La Crosse, and also an effort of the YWCA called the Reach Center, which offers a lot of different social services access to not just people without traditional housing, but many different kinds of people who find themselves in hard times. Mayor Reynolds talked about a plan that he was working out, which has now come to pass to get some of the people who were living at the time in Huska Park into some hotel space here in the area for the winter. Thankfully, that has happened. But here is Mayor Mitch Reynolds talking about how, at least in the short term, having them there in the park turned out to be a better option than what was previously available.
It's one of our parks. We have 47 parks in the city of La Crosse. This is one that we identified as a place where we could create a stable, temporary place where we are our unsheltered population could at least spend the night without getting rousted out and pushed along and moved to somewhere else. And this certainly, when you talk about untenable situations, this was never meant to be any kind of ideal solution in any kind of way. We're just trying to gain some level of stability for the people who are spending their nights outdoors. I was just at the park yesterday and I was talking to some of the folks living down there and talking about our plans for the future and what we're planning on right now. And this is subject to city council approval, which I don't anticipate a problem with, but what we're planning on doing is renting some space and rooms here to get everybody indoors. And then, you know, work with along with the Salvation Army and Catholic Charities in moving as many people indoors. I think we can get everyone indoors. And that's my goal. They want to be behind a locked door. They want to have their, you know, their therapy pet with them. They want to have some assurance that their belongings won't get removed when they, you know, when they go and get food at the convenience store. You know, it's a temporary solution. Clearly, this is not a permanent solution for us. We're working on that as well. So permanent transitional housing, a long-term process for kind of a wraparound care. So we're addressing issues upstream of some of the outcomes that we're seeing in terms of our unsheltered population and other poor outcomes. We have a lot of different things that we're working on, but immediately the goal is to get everybody indoors.
Lauren Juno from YWCA, I gather that this is a big part of your effort to help get these organizations space in a same facility that they can all be close together and help those in need. Talk about what's going on there at the Reach Center.
Absolutely. Well, we officially opened October 14th. We cut the ribbon on the building and officially opened it as the Reach Services and Resource Center. This project is the product of a lot of hard work from multiple agencies and partners in the community who saw a need and wanted to go for it. We saw an opportunity and thought, what's one thing that we haven't been able to do in this community that we've wanted to do for a long time? And that was to cohabitate and bring resources together so that when individuals need support or need resources, they don't have to go to four different agencies to find it. Now they can walk in one building, and when someone walks in and says, hi, I need somewhere to live. I also need clothing. I also need food. My children need supplies for school. We could use utility assistance. All of those things can be found under one roof.
Lauren Juno of the YWCA and La Crosse Mayor Mitch Reynolds talking about the Reach Center, which is now open, and also the effort to combat homelessness throughout La Crosse. We're taking a look back in the rearview mirror on Newsmakers this week at 2021. One of the big stories in our area in 2021 was, of course, the refugees that were evacuated from Afghanistan last year ended up in a few different locations in the United States and elsewhere, including at Fort McCoy here in our listening area. And so we have been following that story at WPR. And Karen Becker of Catholic Charities of the La Crosse Diocese has been on our show a couple of different times talking about their efforts at Fort McCoy.
I do know that originally when I had heard about a month ago that there were 13,000 individuals around that number out there, 48% were under the age of 18 at that point in time. So we do have a lot of families. There are going to be over 300 babies born between now and probably the end of February is what they're anticipating, which
wow.
Carrie, maybe you can testify to as well. That does slow, I don't know if it slows down or speeds up the process, but we do know they don't want them traveling in that last trimester. So we've got a lot of families on there. And it's, you know what? It's amazing to see all of these young kids. When I drive on base and they literally are usually playing with some of the soldiers, or they stop and they wave and they smile, the joy that they get in learning simple American phrases, hi. All of them learned how to say ball right away because they had nothing. And so they all wanted something to play with. But a lot of kids out there.
As you're doing your work and interacting with the people out there, how have their needs changed since you began working with them on the base?
Well, when they first arrived, the first few that arrived, a lot of them did come with like one bag or maybe a few belongings. When we started seeing a week into it or 2 weeks into it, so many arrived without anything, literally just fleeing, trying to grab their family members and go. Originally what we were trying to do was just make sure that everybody had a change of undergarments, had socks, had the very basic necessities, toothbrush, things like that. We worked closely with the Red Cross was on base at that time. And then shortly after that, Team Rubicon came on. So all of these NGOs that have continued to work together to provide the basic needs.
Karen, how are languages affecting your work at Fort McCoy, and what have you got in the works to help out with that?
Well, language barrier is definitely one of the main concerns that we have going on at the base. From day one, we have realized that there is two basic languages, as Carrie mentioned, and trying to find a way to communicate and let folks know all of the different services that are available for them on base. We have been very blessed. We made an immediate connection with some of the translators who had worked at the embassy and some of the folks who speak fluent English and in both dialects. And we've also were able to connect with some female university students that were temporarily stationed on base. And it was very interesting to watch the creative way that in some of our women's centers that our volunteers were working with these interpreters and women and children who were coming into our centers, songs like Head, Shoulders, Knees, and Toes, just very creative ways to find fun, but learning. We also have a learning center that we have opened where we have one retired English American teacher, but we have engaged several Afghanistan former teachers who are working, or university students who are working with the area children. The first learning center that we opened, we were going to take 100 to 150 students. And within the first couple of days, we had over 200 students registered. I think one of the first experiences I had was with a young lady who was probably about 16 who spoke beautiful English. And she loved having a conversation with me and practicing her English. And she was very proud of the fact that she had learned at the academy. And she took great pride in that. And it was exciting to have that conversation with her and know that being here now, her education, she'll be able to continue it.
That's Karen Becker of Catholic Charities of the La Crosse Diocese. Congressman Ron Kind, Wisconsin's 3rd Congressional District Representative, made news last year when he announced that he would not be seeking re-election to his seat, so the term that he's currently involved in will be his last in the Congress. We talked to him a couple weeks before the new year, that is, about the historic infrastructure bill, historic in its size and scope, and which will ultimately result in billions of dollars heading to Wisconsin. Congressman Kind talked about what that might look like for our area.
And let me say, you know, at the top, this bill was paid for. No deficit spending, no borrowing against our children's future. We took time to find offsets in order to pay for this over a 10-year period. So it's very fiscally responsible while rebuilding Wisconsin, rebuilding America the way it should be, coming out of this global pandemic. I can't think of a better time to rebuild Wisconsin and the good paying jobs that will flow from it. So I'm looking forward in the coming months to see this money hit the ground quite literally in Wisconsin, from roads, highways, bridges, airports that we have, infrastructure along our inland waterways, to a major expansion in broadband funding, including that last mile, difficult areas in rural Wisconsin, clean drinking water investment throughout the state, which is crucial right now, EV charging stations, everything to get us ready for the modern economy so we're in a better position to compete globally.
You mentioned a lot of categories here. Is there something that you're particularly excited to see some funding for coming to Wisconsin, to the 3rd District?
Yeah, you know, our infrastructure hardware was, of course, desperately needed and upgraded. Our roads, our highways, our bridges, close to half our rural bridges in Wisconsin were rated as deficient. The National Electrical Engineers Association graded us a C as a state overall when it came to our infrastructure. But one area I worked particularly hard at, Isra, and I served on a nonpartisan National Broadband Commission. There's a lot of the work that we put in over the last couple of years on broadband expansion, closing the digital divide, got included in this bill. And I represent, you know, a fairly large rural Western Wisconsin district. And I know these rural communities. I know the rural residents. They've been shut off for too long as far as the information superhighway, having high-speed internet connection in their businesses or in their homes. And we saw this manifest itself during the pandemic, from the digital divide that affected kids and distance learning to telehealth and the need for continued healthcare services. So all this is important for the modern economy and making sure that we don't leave anyone behind.
One of the things that you mentioned was the C grade that that Wisconsin's infrastructure has been given by the national organization that runs the report card for American infrastructure. Toward that end, this bill provides, if the information that I've read about it is accurate, about just less than $5.5 billion, about $5.2 billion in funding for highways in Wisconsin. But in terms of the need, like, how far is that $5.2 billion going to go? It sounds like an awful lot of money to a guy like me, but like when you start actually paying for paving projects, that gets really expensive.
Yeah, you know, $5.2 billion is not chump change, as they say. Yeah. It should go a long ways in Wisconsin. And we've done a pretty good job as a state, always coming together, trying to figure out a way of maintaining basic maintenance. But that's been catching up with us in recent years. And listen, Madison has been tied up in knots just as bad as Washington has when it came to infrastructure investment. In fact, Madison still hasn't passed anything comprehensive yet. And I think the problem with them is the same problem we wrestled with. How do you pay for it? You know, without bonding, without going into debt to do all this. And so they've been stalemated in the legislature in Madison. And that's why I think it was so satisfying to see us come together here in Washington in a bipartisan fashion, find areas of compromise, find respectable offsets in the budget to pay for this infrastructure package so we can move forward. And that we wouldn't just have another infrastructure week that died on the limb and nothing came of it. I think that was frustrating a lot of people. And it's kind of the basics of governance, too, is making sure that there are safe roads and highways and bridges for people to travel on. Major investment in this bill for public transit, too, understanding that not everyone can afford their own car for their transportation and work needs. But the quality water infrastructure needs, too, I think can't be overstated. And we're going to be getting, what was it, like $142 million on quality water initiatives. I'm talking about the nitrates and phosphorus, groundwater contamination that's affecting too many areas of the state. If you don't have clean drinking water, it's going to be hard to sustain that community. I think we all realize that. This bill is going to go a long ways helping identify, clean that up. PFAS remediation, of course, right on French Island, a major problem right now. We had seed money in the American Rescue Plan that passed earlier this year that went back to townships like French Island, the town of Campbell, to the city of La Crosse, the county of La Crosse. Ultimately, the state of Wisconsin got $2.4 billion in the American Rescue Plan. I made sure that that money under that plan could be used to deal with PFAS remediation, cleanup, and making sure we get out of this trouble. This infrastructure bill will double down on that right now and make sure that there are resources available. So when the local community comes together and establishes a workable plan, and we're working hard to do that right now, but there's going to be resources backing them up in order to accomplish it. And again, this is fundamental to people's lives. They got to be able to rely that the children are drinking safe water and they're not going to develop cancer in their lives. So we recognize that in this infrastructure bill and in the American Rescue Plan. And I'm encouraging our local governing bodies to look at these pools of money now as tools in order to fix this problem.
That's Congressman Ron Kind here on Newsmakers in December of 2021. Well, that's the year in review on Newsmakers. I hope everybody's 2022 has been off to a good start. And let me throw this opportunity out to you. If you have an idea of something that you'd like us to cover in the new year and beyond, please let us know about it. I'd love to hear from you. Our email is newsmakers@wpr.org. That's newsmakers@wpr.org. Remember, there are a couple of opportunities here to hear the show every week. We originate on Friday mornings at 10 on the Ideas Network 90.3. Then we repeat on Friday evenings at 7 on NPR News and Music 88.9. Dawn Jewell produces Newsmakers, and I appreciate her help as always. I'm Ezra Wall. Join us again next time for another Newsmakers right here on Wisconsin Public Radio.